Good morning. The court calls United States versus Behenna. Counsel for the appellant.
May it please the court. I am Jack Zimmerman, along with Terry Zimmerman and Captain Pat Gilman. We speak for Lieutenant Michael Behenna. When Lieutenant Behenna shot and killed Ali Mansour because he was in fear for his life, that shifted the burden of persuasion to the government to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. That's issue one. In issue two, Dr. McDonald's opinion was relevant to the issue of self-defense on findings and also on sentence. With regard to issue one, the improper wording of this limiting instruction is...
Can I ask just quickly
yes,
how you link the two issues?
I think they are very intertwined.
If you can you prevail on the second issue if you don't prevail on the first issue?
We can, the honest answer to that is that we can prevail on the sentence argument, but it would be difficult for us to prevail on the findings argument.
Check.
Okay. Leaving aside the form of the instruction for the moment.
Yes, sir.
How is self-defense raised here? I assume you agree that if self-defense isn't raised here, then the instruction is gratuitous.
Yes.
Okay.
Self-defense was raised, Your Honor, by the testimony of Lieutenant Behenna.
Okay. Lieutenant Behenna is in full battle rattle.
Yes.
Armed.
Yes.
The decedent is stripped, naked, unarmed.
Yes.
They are off by themselves.
Correct.
Okay. Now, how's this self-defense situation?
All right, first of all, you have to put it in context.
It's not a battlefield situation. He's not claiming battlefield privilege or anything like that.
It's not a firefight, but it is a combat zone, and that's important, and I'm glad you brought that up. The history between these two is that Ali Mansour had been the subject of intelligence reports.
I'm aware of that. I'm aware that, Lieutenant Behenna had already threatened to kill him.
Well, we also are aware that Lieutenant Behenna had a bona fide good faith belief that Ali Mansour was a terrorist leader. And we have to keep the context. We're in a...
But what's the relevance of that?
The state of mind. Why Lieutenant Behenna felt it was necessary to have that weapon in order to continue what he believed to be an interrogation that was not conducted properly by higher...
Okay, was this an authorized interrogation?
It was not authorized.
It was not.
No.
Okay, go ahead.
And let me just finish that issue and then get back. We've got a 10-foot-wide culprit. The testimony is uncontroverted that they are a foot, each was a foot away from it, so we're now down to 8 feet between them. And then they each have their body, which be another 2 feet, so we're now down to 6 feet. And when their hands are outstretched, they're 2 or 3 feet apart. So when he fired in self-defense, he had a bond. His testimony, the answer to your question is self-defense was raised by his testimony. He thought he was reaching for the lieutenant's pistol, and his life was in danger. And that's why he fired in self-defense.
Okay. Was Lieutenant Behenna an aggressor?
Technically, under civilian self-defense law, yes.
What's the difference?
Well, Judge, I think we have to consider the situation. I know you...
You're trying to consider the context.
Yes.
But he's not privileged in a battlefield way to kill him.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Then what's the relevance?
What is the relevance?
The relevance of the context. He's armed, the decedent's not. He's armored, the decedent's stripped. They're sitting in a culvert. Where's the self-defense? Where's the escalation? Where's...
We don't believe escalation was raised.
And okay.
One of the issues, if I could tell you what I think is wrong with this limiting instruction, there are two things that are wrong with it. First is that the military judge tells the members, in effect, that by merely pointing a weapon at Ali Mansour, that he was committing assault. No instructions on assault given relative to this. So how are the members supposed to find assault?
Well, but I'm not really concerned here with the form of the instruction. I'm concerned with whether the issue's raised at all.
Look, hang on for 1 second. Yeah. Counsel, just finish your thoughts so you can get your two things on the table, and then you can continue on. You had two thoughts.
There are two
Put number two on the table, please.
The two things that are wrong with this limiting instruction. are that there was no definition of what the members had to find to determine that he lost his right to self-defense. The judge instructed them that self-defense was raised, and it was raised. I don't think that's an issue, legally.
Quickly state your two items so that you can then continue.
Escalation was required for Lieutenant Bahena to regain his right if he lost it.
That's the use of and in the conjunctive rather than the disjunctive.
And I will tell you, in all honesty, we have sat down with lawyers. We have read that instruction. It's at Joint Appendix pages 215 and 16.
Now, could you please return to Judge Stuckey's question then, which is, that's fine, point one and point two, but what if, in what manner was he entitled to self-defense instruction at all? Is that
my question.
And in that context, please answer the question using Stanley.
Yes. If he had a good faith belief that he was in danger of receiving either death or grievous bodily harm as a result of Ali Mansour taking his pistol and using it on him, and he had the right to defend himself.
But how does your argument work or not work, and this is a neutral question, in light of this court's recent decision in Stanley?
Well, Your Honor.
Are you familiar with Stanley?
Yes, and
okay.
I believe it.
Understanding that this is not a farmhouse in Kansas.
Right. In addition to that difference, we think Stanley was an escalation issue case. Everything else in there was dicta that supported the decision that because escalation was not raised by the evidence, it's not improper or an escalation instruction was not warranted. We believe that applies, that part of Stanley applies directly to this situation. The judge instructed a verdict of guilty when he required the members to find escalation in order for self-defense to be retained.
Why, my question then might be more direct. Why is or is not going into the culvert with your weapon drawn with Mansour, why is that not the equivalent of coming out of the closet with weapons? Stanley coming out of the closet with weapons brandished.
Well, it may be, and what at my recollection of the holding in Stanley is that escalation was not raised by that scenario that you found in Stanley. We're saying it wasn't raised here and it shouldn't have been given. Because when the judge required them to find escalation, he in effect told them that an assault had occurred, and there was never any instructions on what they had to find for assault. There was never any proof put in that under the law that an assault occurred. No elements were given. What guideposts did the members have to determine whether or not there had been an assault, and therefore he had lost his rights to self-defense in the first place?
Counsel, you mentioned several times that the instruction that was given was confusing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you specifically point out the portions of that instruction that are confusing, and why are they confusing?
Yes, Your Honor. The double negatives is what really are confusing. It says that if you have a reasonable doubt that the accused assaulted Ali Mansour, was provoked by Ali Mansour, or had some other legal justification or excuse, and you are not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that Ali Mansour did not escalate. So it's the double negatives. And what does that initial phrase modify when he says, if you have a reasonable doubt that the accused assaulted Ali Mansour? Are they also supposed to have reasonable doubt that he was provoked by him? Or was it, did that apply to the third one? It's just confusing.
Are you arguing it's a misstatement of the law?
It is.
It's a confusing statement.
No, I think it... Well, remember that the members asked for instructions in writing. That was denied. Then he read it to them again because they didn't understand it. There's a specific question written by one of the members. Can you re-explain how an assault nullifies self-defense? And so they were asking for instructions. They didn't get them. They weren't given the guideposts that they needed to do that. That's why we think it's confusing. And the double negatives are confusing. That's the primary thing.
Counsel, with respect to the comment you made earlier about civilian life.
I'm sorry?
If the comment you made earlier about civilian life.
Yes.
If a police officer in civilian life conducted an interrogation in the fashion here, and the weapon was brandished for purposes of conducting the interrogation, Would that police officer have the right to self-defense if the person being interrogated made a move towards the officer to obtain the weapon, or is there something that's unique about the military here? I understand your argument about uniqueness in the military, but what's the status in civilian life?
I think that the cases that we cited, page 30 and 31 of our opening brief on the section 1983 civil rights cases, answers your question. The civilian circuit courts of appeal have held that what happens prior to the instant that the officer has to react in self-defense is irrelevant for the issue of whether he had the right to act in self-defense. So the answer to your question is, you do not, for those purposes, consider anything that happened before. And we're asking you to apply that analogy to this case as well.
So my understanding is that while you're asking us to take into account these circumstances, you are not asking for a unique military rule here. Is that correct?
A unique military rule? I think that what we would ask you perhaps to do is clarify the law that all of the circumstances need to be taken into account.
Let's not talk about clarifying the law. Let's talk about the law as it stands right now in the military and as it stands right now in civilian life. And I understand you're asking us to take into account the military circumstances, but are you asking us to establish a different rule in the military than exists in civilian life for a parallel interrogation?
No, I'm not.
Thank you.
Judge Ryan, did you have a question?
No. Could you turn to the second issue for a moment, if you don't mind?
I sure will. The favorable opinion that we're talking about in this case that was not disclosed was that Dr. McDonald, one of the leading experts in the country on this, said that the most logical explanation for the physical evidence was that Ali Mansour was standing when he was shot first.
And when was that opinion formed?
Wednesday afternoon, when he demonstrated the most logical explanation to the prosecutors and the government experts and two paralegals. It was done on Wednesday afternoon. Our position is that's when it should have been disclosed. And I see my time is moving quickly, so if I may.
I'd like to ask you a question on this topic.
Yes, Chief Judge.
Paragraph 17 of the military judge's findings and conclusions states that Dr. McDonald's now new opinion, although consistent with, was not cumulative, not sure what that means, to any evidence which had been introduced during trial. So the question is, in what way or in what way not was McDonald's evidence cumulative with the two defense experts' testimony at trial?
Well, it was not cumulative.
Well, I understand, but the judge doesn't indicate why it was not.
Well, because it was...
What's the delta? What's the gap between the two? Since they both said it's a possibility he was standing, it's a possibility this, it was a possibility that. What was McDonald bringing that the other two did not bring?
An analysis of the spent bullet that was found at the scene that he examined Thursday that was not available to the other experts that confirmed his Wednesday opinion. Also, he's a blood spatter expert. Tom Bevel also was a blood spatter expert, but didn't get into the detail that Dr. McDonald could have done. And quite frankly, Your Honor, there's a big difference between the defense calling a defense expert and a government-retained expert. And we've cited the cases in our briefs where the not only this court, but most of the courts have dealt with it say that if the government's own expert agrees, as he did in this case, then that's a significant factor for the finders of fact.
But when did the government know that?
Know what, Judge?
Know that.
They knew his opinion when he demonstrated the only logical...
No, he said it was highly improbable.
Well, he did say it was highly unlikely, Judge.
He said it was highly unlikely. How did the government really know this until 1607 on Friday when he sent him the message?
Well, because on Thursday... After Thursday morning, he examined the spent bullet, and then on Thursday afternoon, he listened to Lieutenant Behenna's testimony. Then he was excused, which is sort of odd in its own right. But
after he listened to the testimony, did he say anything to anyone who was connected with the government?
Yes, he did.
What did he say, and who did he say it to?
He tapped Dr. Berg, the government pathologist, on the shoulder and said, "That's exactly what I told you yesterday." Then we broke. The director was over waiting for, there was a reason.
Not asking you to testify, asking you what's in the record.
Sir?
not asking you to testify. I'm asking you what's in the record.
Well, this is all in the record, yes. He testified, and he also submitted an affidavit. And when he left, back to this room in the courthouse, his testimony was that he told the three prosecutors in room 13, that's exactly what I told you yesterday, and his response was that their reaction was very cold, and they told him to go ahead and go back to New York. That was on Thursday afternoon. The 1607 was Friday, Judge.
The judge didn't find that, did he? The judge disagreed with that, did he not, in his findings of fact?
He did, and he misunderstood the testimony, and if you review the testimony...
But the judge's findings of fact found that this Thursday conversation didn't take place, right?
I'm not sure.
Well, not the conversation with the other expert. The alleged conversation with the trial counsel.
I'm not sure he said it didn't take place, but I think it didn't take place the way
Okay.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Check your clock there. You certainly can finish answering Judge Stuckey's question if you would like, and if there are any other questions.
I can finish answering my question.
Well, let me just say that this issue is very fact-intensive, and we don't have time to go through this, but it's very well set out, we think, in our brief from Wednesday through Saturday.
Well, I have one follow-up question. You said the delta between what was cumulative or not cumulative was the bullet analysis. The fact that it was the government's consultant / expert in blood spatter knowledge.
Yes.
Where in the record would you refer us if you wanted to make your best argument as to what the bullet analysis would have been?
It is...
And you can cite the pages on rebuttal if you like,
yes,
or you
I
can
will.
Just rattle them off now if you would like.
I will. I can tell you exactly where it is, but I can't tell you the page by memory. It's when...
If you were wanting to make sure that we focus precisely on what it was you wanted to argue, please say on rebuttal which pages you would refer to. This is the delta.
Yes, sir.
Fair enough?
Yes. Now,
okay. You're overread, but that's fine. You have time on rebuttal as well.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government, please.
Good morning. Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Stephen Latino, along with Lieutenant Colonel Amber Roach, represent the government. The appellant, unauthorized without any legal justification or excuse, took Allie Mansour to a covert in the desert, stripped him naked down to his sandals, threatened to kill him if he did not give the appellant the information he desired. These unlawful acts by the appellant culminated in Allie Mansour's death. Now, turning first to the issue of the military judge's instructions, the military judge, using his considerable discretion, properly instructed the panel on the affirmative defense of self-defense. Under RCM 920, the military judge may...
Counsel, did the government introduce evidence at trial that the acts were not only unauthorized, but that they were unlawful? That is, unlawful in the sense that it would have been subject to prosecution under the UCMJ.
Yes, Your Honor. Turning first... The appellant admitted he appointed the weapon because this guy's not telling me the information. That's a JA-195. He stated it was not an authorized technique to scare Mr. Mansour.
That's not my question. My question is not whether it was authorized. The question is, what evidence did the government introduce and what was demonstrated at trial to show that it was unlawful? I'm not asking for your legal conclusion as to whether it was unlawful, but at trial, did the government contend that it was unlawful under the UCMJ?
Your Honor, it would be the government's position that the evidence isn't in total of the unlawfulness. When you look at the fact that there wasn't an authorized mission and what the appellant was doing. Furthermore, the military judge himself has that sua sponte responsibility to look at the evidence and to look at the law when crafting his instructions. So when the military judge is crafting his instructions, he's looking to see whether or not the law would justify that and how to frame the question for the panel to decide. And that's what occurred in this case when he said...
Yeah, so where did he go through the discussion of lawfulness in the military under Article 91, 92? Where did he do that and instruct the members on the question of unlawfulness?
Your Honor, it's the government's position that when he was instructing on the assault, when he said that the appellant may have been assaulting Allie Mansour by pointing a loaded weapon at him and then went through the legal justification or excuse, he's embodying that. He's framing the issue. He's framing the evidence to the law when talking about self-defense and whether the actions of the appellant were lawful.
How do the members know anything about the issue of lawfulness on that instruction with respect to what is or is not authorized with regard to interrogation?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the fact that it was not a lawful interrogation would mean that everything that came from everything that was done in that unlawful interrogation would be subject to...
No, but where did the judge instruct them that it was an unlawful interrogation?
Your Honor, it's the government's position that he doesn't need to instruct them on the unlawful interrogation. He's instructing on the...
Is your answer that no, he didn't instruct them that it was an unlawful interrogation?
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
What is your response to the appellant's argument that the instruction was flawed because it was provided in the conjunctive with respect to escalation?
Your Honor, we respectfully
follow the question.
Yes, Your Honor, we respectfully disagree with the appellant on this. When you look at the entire paragraph of the instruction and you look at the military judges instructing the panel, if they find that the appellant did not assault Ali Mansour, that is, that the pointing of a loaded weapon was not unlawful, then what we're left with is two individuals in a culvert to each other. Now, for self-defense to apply, there has to be some escalation. And in this case, the escalation is not escalating above pointing a loaded weapon, but merely escalating a situation where it's two individuals in a culvert. And that's when you read and pare apart the sentence structure of the military judge in this instruction, you can see that he's stating, if you have reasonable doubt that the appellant assaulted Ali Mansour, you have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that Ali Mansour escalated the level of force, and then you must conclude that the accused had a right to self-defense. When looking at the double negatives in this case, you take out the two nots, and you would read the sentence in the affirmative, and that's how traditionally in the English language we look at double negatives.
Well, isn't that awfully confusing? I mean, if I were, I read this instruction about four times, and it is very confusing. And I'm a judge of this court. If I'm Captain X and I'm on this panel, and I hear this thing, and I don't have it in front of me in writing, I hear this thing, and what am I supposed to do?
Well, Your Honor, it is confusing.
I mean, sure, the judge has broad discretion in framing instructions, but he's got to frame instructions that are, one, accurate, and two, understandable.
Correct, Your Honor. We believe it is accurate and understandable. When the panel came back and said, we need to understand this, and had that read back to them, if the panel member...
Did the judge do anything more than simply read it back to them?
He did not, Your Honor. He read them to them and asked them if that answered their question, to which the panel member said, yes, it did.
Counsel,
to that effect.
I'd like to take a look at just the second phrase of that instruction. And that second clause, taking out the reasonable doubt in the legal wording and everything, it seems to say to me that if the members didn't think that Behenna was provoked by AM, which is the first part of it there, and that AM did not escalate the level of force, then Behenna had the right to self-defense. And that seems to me to be an inaccurate statement of the law.
Your Honor, I understand Your Honor's question.
Well, walk through that for me and explain how that is an accurate statement of the law, that if they had a reasonable doubt that the accused was provoked and were not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that AM did not escalate, in other words...
Right. If there were reasonable doubt that Ali Mansour provoked the appellant, then they would have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that Ali Mansour escalated the level of force. And when we look at this instruction, I believe that's the proper reading that comes of what was given to the panel.
And the government thinks that's clear?
Your Honor, it was not as clear as... It was not crystal clear or perfectly clear, but it was clear enough to the panel when they came back and asked for the military judge to read them back to them that they understood it at that point, or they gave the affirmative that they understood what the military judge was saying.
Counsel, perhaps you could help us. The sentence that's being referred to has six separate determinations that the members must make. It involves two different standards. One is reasonable doubt, and the other is not beyond a reasonable doubt, and it contains a double negative. Now, either through, you referred to common understanding, either through diagramming the sentence in the old-fashioned way or just in plain English with as many sentences as you want. What does that last sentence say? In the government's view, what is being communicated by the words in that last sentence?
Your Honor, I will break it down in several sentences.
Sure.
First, it would be, however, if you have reasonable doubt that the accused assaulted Ali Mansour, and you weren't convinced beyond reasonable doubt that Ali Mansour did escalate the level of force, then you must conclude that the accused had the right to self-defense. Second, if you have reasonable doubt that the accused is, if you have reasonable doubt that the accused was provoked by Ali Mansour, and you are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that Ali Mansour did escalate the level of force, then you must conclude that the accused had the right to self-defense. And finally, if you have reasonable doubt that the accused had some other legal justification or excuse, and you are not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that Ali Mansour did escalate the level of force, then you must conclude that the accused had the right to self-defense.
So you disagree with the position of the defense, then, that in civilian life, a police officer who pointed a weapon at a person being interrogated for the purpose of interrogation would lose the right of self-defense if the person being interrogated then jumped the officer?
Correct, Your Honor. The person being interrogated in that moment, unlawfully interrogated by the police officer, would retain the right to self-defense against that police officer. And then...
And the police officer would have no right of self-defense when they're being jumped?
A police officer could possibly regain a right to self-defense, but that the amount of force used by the witness in that the person being interrogated in that moment must go beyond that being authorized or being used by the police officer. However, in this case, when we're talking about a loaded weapon, you're talking about the use of deadly force. So you're not really going to see, there's nothing a witness or Ali Mansour in this case could have done to have escalated the level beyond that was being used by appellant if they found that using the weapon was indeed an assault.
To put it another way, then, it's the government's view that the law is, if a police officer misunderstands the law and is conducting an interrogation with a weapon, then the police officer has no right to defend himself if the person being interrogated then jumps the officer. He has to just sit there and take whatever happens.
Yes, Your Honor, because we would look at the totality of the circumstances in that you look at the entire transaction as it occurs. And when the police officer does something like that unlawfully, he would lose the right to self-defense.
Assuming for the sake of argument that there is error in the instruction, what is the government's argument for why it is or is not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
No, we would argue that it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And when we look at the overwhelming evidence in this case was that the pointing of a weapon by the appellant was unjustified, unlawful, and it was an assault with a loaded weapon. And therefore, nothing Ali Mansour could have done would have escalated the level of force beyond that assault with a loaded weapon. So in this situation, there was nothing the appellant could do, short of withdrawing, which is not an issue in this case, to regain the right to self-defense. So any error is harmless.
To be clear, does that mean it's the government's view that once they went into the culvert, weapon drawn, appellant was not entitled to use self-defense unless he came out of the culvert first?
Yes, Your Honor, that could be a situation. There would have to be an adequate withdrawal, something where the appellant took himself out. He could have sent Ali Mansour on his way walking home, and that also possibly could have been a withdrawal in the circumstances where appellant would regain the right to self-defense.
But we're talking about a scenario in which the appellant would have a right of self-defense once inside the culvert.
If I understood your question properly, Your Honor, the appellant did have Ali Mansour did have the right to self-defense when in the culvert.
Ali Mansour, the appellant.
The appellant, once
he would have had to withdraw, no other scenario would have otherwise presented a self-defense context for him.
Yes, Your Honor.
So again, we're now talking about the issue of harmlessness, assuming that the error is that the instruction was an error. And as I understand the government's view, no reasonable court-martial panel could conclude that there was a defense of self-defense here in that circumstance when an officer makes a mistake, an officer not trained as a policeman, makes a mistake as to the conduct of an interrogation, that no reasonable panel could conclude that self-defense applies then. We're not asking about the self-defense question I asked earlier. We're talking about whether the panel itself could conclude it.
Right. I believe the panel itself could not, although I would take issue with the use of the word mistake. I don't think it was a mistake by the appellant of what he did. It was he planned to do it. There was no mistake. He was not confused on whether he was authorized to do it.
No, I understand that. But the question here is whether it's a mistake or a misjudgment, whatever error the individual made in conducting the interrogation, that no panel could conclude, in your view, that the person had a self-defense in terms of the panel determination, even when instructed by this, like this. Your view, apparently, is that the judge's instruction is not error because the panel could not return a verdict of self-defense, or excuse me, a verdict of acquittal based on self-defense under these facts, that no set of facts here would lead a panel to acquit.
The panel, following the instructions by the military judge, taking the evidence in front of it and taking to the laws given to by the military judge, a panel could not conclude that self-defense was used in this case. It was raised by some evidence, so there's a requirement for the instruction. However, a panel, when taking the evidence and the instructions back to the deliberation room, would not come back with any other result.
If it's raised by some evidence, then isn't it in play?
Your Honor, it is in play by the low standard of some evidence. But when we're looking at beyond reasonable doubt, there is no other way that the panel could have looked at this and not found that it was indeed assault and the appellant did not have a right to self-defense.
Why doesn't some evidence raise a reasonable doubt? What's the difference between the some evidence standard and the reasonable doubt standard? What case would you rely on to say that there's a distinction there?
Your Honor, I don't have a case offhand. However, to think about it, in cases for the military judge to instruct, there just has to be some evidence. So if some evidence meant that you could never have beyond a reasonable doubt finding the other way, then there would be, the military judge would have made a directed finding there was some evidence of self-defense, therefore.
I don't think so. I think that some evidence could be disregarded by the members and therefore they could return a verdict of guilty. That's not, the question here isn't whether there was evidence upon which they could return a verdict of guilty. The Jackson standard isn't at issue here. The issue is whether there was some evidence upon which they could have returned a verdict of not guilty.
Your Honor, the government just doesn't believe there's any evidence, there's not even some evidence that the appellant could have come back with a finding of not guilty.
Counsel, before you turn to issue two, I just have one final question on escalation. As I read this instruction, if there is no escalation, then there's no right to self-defense. Would you agree with that?
I would not agree. If there is no escalation by Ali Mansour, and there is no assault by...
No, I'm just saying that the part there, if you're not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that AM did not escalate the level of force. So that has to be there in order to get, you must conclude the accused had the right to self-defense. So if there's no escalation, it seems to me that this instruction is saying there's no right to self-defense.
Your Honor, I agree, because when we look at the totality of the instruction, it starts by saying the accused may have been assaulting Ali Mansour. If there is no assault, there is no unlawful use of force, there is nothing to raise self-defense. It is.
What's your short answer to Judge Erdman's question? He presented it in a yes or no manner.
My short answer is that when there is no violence toward either party, there is no right to self-defense.
If there's no escalation, there's no right to self-defense. Is that what this instruction says?
Yes, Your Honor. Turning to the second assignment of error, I think it's critical to look at what Dr. McDonald's expert opinion is here. Dr. McDonald's a blood splatter.
Hang on, I want to ask a couple questions. What is the favorable information, if any, that was suppressed?
Your Honor, the government doesn't think there is anything favorable. We think Dr. McDonald's opinion on Wednesday evening at JA 267, where he says that the Ali Mansour was either sitting or standing, was his opinion as of Wednesday night. And that's neither favorable or material to the defense of this case. If the forensic evidence in this case did not lend itself to a single interpretation.
It would not be favorable to know that the government's consultant agreed that it was possible that this is how it all played out?
Your Honor, it was Dr. McDonald's opinion that it could be either.
Didn't the military judge find it was favorable?
Your Honor, the military judge found... that's the essence of what the government's arguing today. We got to look at what Dr. McDonald's opinion was.
Well, what did the military judge find on that?
I'd say paragraph 10 on JA 312 at the end of the presentation of evidence on Wednesday, Dr. McDonald's opinion, notwithstanding the testimony of Dr. Radoff and Mr. Bevel, was the forensic evidence did not contradict the government's theory of the case. and presumably based on other evidence known to him, which are the other eyewitnesses, he disagreed with Mr. Bevel's conclusion that Ali Mansour was standing when he was shot.
In the government's view, with respect to paragraph 17, is the evidence that Dr. McDonald would have presented cumulative or not cumulative with what the evidence was from the other two experts?
Your Honor, it would not be. My understanding of paragraph 17 is the military judge has explained that it would not be cumulative because of his expertise as a blood splatter expert and giving testimony as that. However, looking at what he's saying is it's just a new opinion that has not been introduced by trial.
So, what about the appellant's argument that not only was he a blood spatter expert, he also went into bullet analysis, and he was, of course, the government's consultant?
Your Honor, I would not proffer that Dr. McDonald is an expert on bullet analysis, but he can take other experts' opinions into consideration in forming his own opinion. So he took the trajectory testimony that you heard directly to the bullets. And that's why you have at JA-267 him saying that with a blood splatter, and the blood splatter does not lend itself to a single interpretation, that he was either sitting or standing in the two scenarios that ensued of how Allen Mansour was shot in each of those scenarios.
Counsel, on page JA-255, phrases, the only thing that I can come up with consistent with all the facts as I know them would be that he probably was shot on the side with his arm up. Did either of the defense witnesses testify that that was the only consistent theory with the facts?
No, Your Honor, but Dr. McDonald, in his testimony here, he contradicts himself. So when you look later, he's saying, as of Wednesday, there were two scenarios. And when you look at what he keeps saying, he's always saying there are always other possibilities at 271. And he couldn't rule out that the eyewitnesses are correct at JA-268. He's always trying to think of alternative explanations at JA-259 and 260.
Right, but I understand that. But why wouldn't the members be the ones who would decide which aspect of that expert's testimony they were going to give credence to? And why wouldn't defense be able to argue that there's no inconsistency between the only logical explanation and the existence of other possibilities? Why isn't that a function for the members to decide rather than for the judge to decide in excluding discovery?
Your Honor, I think it's two answers to that question. The first would be looking at it as the whether it was material and favorable and what was known to the trial counsels. And the trial counsels are getting mixed stories from Dr. McDonald that there are these multitude of possibilities. So looking at that, looking at the fact that he's interpreting the evidence in many ways and in different ways and contradicting himself, there's nothing material and favorable there. However, if getting my second point, if it is material and favorable, then we go to the analysis of harmless beyond reasonable doubt. The government believes that it is harmless beyond reasonable doubt because if you look at what Dr. McDonald was saying, in his own testimony of the 39A, he's already shown every way he would have been impeached because he keeps contradicting himself on the evidence. So any weight, there would be virtually no weight given to Dr. McDonald's testimony to the ultimate conclusion, if that is his ultimate conclusion, that he was raising his arm because he keeps contradicting himself using all these phrases of anything is possible.
Counsel, your time is up. Are there other questions from the bench?
Just one question.
Please.
Counsel, do you have a view as to whether the disclosure was timely or untimely?
Your Honor, we would say that disclosure was timely.
And what facts in the military judge's findings best support that view? Just list them, don't argue them.
Indicating as well when that occurred.
Your Honor, I think there's two answers to that. The first would be that when the military judge cited Carter v. Bell, stating that the defense counsel at that moment, when Dr. McDonald said, "I'd be a great witness for you," had the necessary components to put it together. The second point would be that the standard itself is going to be practical. And when trial counsel was informed on Friday morning of what the trial defense counsel told him about Dr. McDonald being a great witness, it's as soon as it's practicality under Article 46 and 701. So when we looked at that practicality, the same day turnover and at this moment in trial is not unpractical.
Counsel, I just have a follow-up question on that. I'd like you to take a look at the conclusion of law number one from the part of the military judge. and tell me whether or not that, in fact, is a finding of fact or a conclusion of law. He says, without deciding whether government counsel were obligated to disclose Dr. McDonald's new opinion pursuant to Brady, Dr. McDonald's statement to Mr. Zimmerman was sufficient notice that he possessed favorable, if not exculpatory, information. Now, that seems to me to be a finding of fact rather than a conclusion of law. And sometimes you're mixed, so obviously.
Your Honor, I can see how that can be argued both ways, that the sufficient notice that he possessed favorable, if not exculpatory, information. I believe the military judge was saying it was proper as a conclusion of law, because he's not only taking the fact of when it was disclosed, but he's taking that and he's citing it to a case. Now he's made it a conclusion of law, saying this is final law is enough.
A conclusion of law that it was favorable?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, may I ask one follow-up question? With respect to the Friday morning, turning to the military judge's findings on number 19, a military judge finds that Dr. McDonald did make the statement to Dr. Byrd that the evidence that he heard at trial was exactly what he told the members before. There's a disagreement as to whether he told the other prosecutors. My question is, as of Friday morning, why was or was not the trial counsel obligated or not obligated to talk to the other experts, Dr. Byrd in particular, to determine what, if anything, should be derived from Dr. McDonald based upon the defense counsel going to the trial counsel and saying, McDonald's raised this problem?
Your Honor, the record actually isn't clear on whether that was or was not done or anything that Dr. Byrd could have shed on to that when you look at just the conclusionary statement by Dr. McDonald. That's what I told you yesterday. Just reading that as a party, it looks like that's all Dr. McDonald saying. See, I was able to predict what the appellant was able to say. That's how the forensic evidence could meet up, and not necessarily that it was a change of his opinion.
Understand that it may have been somewhat ambiguous, but why wasn't that at that point something that should have been pursued by the government to determine the question of exculpatory evidence necessary to turn over? They've been alerted by the defense counsel that there was a discussion from McDonald. Why wasn't he obligated to talk to the other members of the defense expert team at that point?
His obligation was as soon as practical, and the record of trial itself just doesn't gleam any information. The trial counsel even asked Dr. Byrd that question, or whether he did or did not, and what the answer was from that. So I think we're speculating too much to go down that road as to whether what actions were not taken by the trial counsel at that point in regards to Dr. Byrd.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. Counsel for the appellant. We'll see where the questions go, but if you need a couple extra minutes, by all means, take it.
Let me address the first issue one, and then Brady, if I may, unless the court would rather me go in the back of the person. I think it's important when the questions from the court to government counsel dealing with the lawfulness issue. Number one, we emphasize no general order was introduced by the government to show there was a violation of an order. No rules of engagement were introduced by the government to show that there was a violation of rules of engagement. The burden was on the government, not on us. And I want to keep emphasizing that on both of these issues, the burden is on the government, and it's on the government today to convince this court on both of these constitutional issues that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and that neither of these issues could have possibly, under Kreitzer, could have possibly contributed to the findings, or in the second issue, to the findings in the sentence. And the other thing that I want to emphasize is the total lack of a record of many of the facts that this court needs to support the government's position. There was no testimony by any of these prosecutors who were present in the courtroom on the motion for mistrial. Dr. Byrd was in the court. If you read that the judge asked for Dr. McDonald to be reached by telephone, which he was, Dr. Byrd was in there. Nobody was called by the government. No affidavit was submitted, no controverting affidavit at either the trial level or the Army Court, which they could have done.
Was the appellant denied the opportunity to call witnesses at that hearing?
I'm sorry, sir.
Was the appellant given the opportunity to call witnesses or request witnesses?
They were, Judge, and let me tell you, there was...
Citing to the record and not to one's own recollection.
The burden was on the government, and they didn't meet at the motion.
So you're making a burden argument on this point.
Yes, the burden was on the government, and and while we're talking about burdens, on this second issue, one of the last, very last things you were talking to government counsel about, the statement that a witness says to a defense counsel, I would have been a good witness for you, is a recitation of the essential facts that lawyer would know what he's talking about when there's been no conversation about that with that witness before, is frankly ludicrous. The burden, first of all, the burden of producing favorable evidence is on the government. And
counsel, what about the second point that the government made, which is that the government disclosed the information based on the findings of fact, that the government disclosed the information at the first practical moment when they first knew about it? And I understand that you have a disagreement as to when they first knew about it, but we're stuck with the record and what the military judge found.
Well, on this issue, Judge, I think there's no deference given to, this is a de novo review, and I don't think...
Not if findings of fact, it's not. It has to be clearly erroneous.
That's right, and we suggest those findings of fact that deal with what the thought processes of the government was, why they did or didn't do something, why they didn't call anybody, what they talked to their supervisors about, if they did, none of that's in the record. And I know this court is very stringent on requiring there to be proof in the record to support a position. And there's a critical lack of factual support for the government's points that they make on this issue in their brief.
I'm not talking about the government's brief. I'm talking about the military judge's findings of fact and conclusions of law, not what's in the government's brief, counsel.
All right, Your Honor. Let me address that.
I mean, can you tell us what's clearly erroneous about the military judge's findings of fact on this point?
On that. Number one, he says that there's a new or revised opinion. The record shows that Dr. McDonald had one opinion that he stuck with. He had one opinion all the way through.
But what does that have to do with the timing issue, counsel? Just on the timing issue.
Because on Wednesday, when we believe the disclosure should have occurred, he demonstrated that any expert's going to say that anything is possible. He told them that the only logical explanation consistent with the physical evidence, and he ticked it off in there what it is, was that Ali Mansour was shot first when he in the chest when he was standing, because the bullet came underneath the right arm, and there was no wound track. There's no wound track in the arm. So his arm was not down, sitting on a rock. Remember this. The government's whole theory was that there was an execution. He never stood up. They never argued this loss of self-defense. That was never presented. We ask you under Obey, on the root, the principle and teachings that this court held in Obey, which cannot affirm a conviction on a theory that was not presented to the members. They never said that there was a failed self-defense. They never argued that he had self-defense and lost it because he was assaulting. That never came up.
They said that he committed premeditated murder.
They did.
And the jury, the members didn't agree. They found him guilty of unpremeditated murder.
On the premeditated part.
So what does that do to your argument about all of this?
About what, Judge? About Oberman?
All of this, I think.
All of this.
You said all.
Yeah. Well, Judge, there also was testimony from a board-certified, experienced psychiatrist that he was suffering from the preliminaries of post-traumatic stress disorder, and there was an instruction on how that affected intent. We don't know from a general verdict why they found him not guilty of premeditated murder, but I suggest to the court that the evidence shows that they may not have been convinced there was a premeditated design to kill, but nonetheless they found him guilty of unpremeditated murder.
Counsel,
yes, sir.
With respect to my question about what was or was not cumulative regarding the experts, you were going to give me some specific references in the record you hoped you would draw my attention to. This is your opportunity to do so. Otherwise, you rely on me to find them on my own.
I don't want to ask you to do that, Judge.
No.
Joint Appendix 302 is where the examination of the bullet is described. And I believe that... In both his testimony in the motion for mistrial and his affidavit on the motion for new trial, he reestablishes all of the things that he said, many of which were not different from Mr.
Thank you. And it's your position that McDonald's opinion was that the only way this could have occurred was by standing. Is that your view?
Yes,
or does the record suggest he indicated that it was a possible way it might have occurred?
Here's what the record is.
I just want record sites here. I'm not trying to get argument. I just want you to say, look at this page and this page to demonstrate that point. This is a record site question, not an argument question.
I will get you the record site to the motion for his testimony on the motion
to substantiate your view.
Yes.
That McDonald's sole opinion was this is the way it had to have occurred.
Yes.
What is your record citation for that, please? And while your co-counsel's looking for that, why don't you take this opportunity to summarize, if you would like, in 1 second, 1 minute or less. Yeah. You can do it in a second, too, if you can, talk quickly.
I should get some kind of advocacy award if I could do it. And frankly, even a minute. But let me just say, Judge, that in answering some of the questions, an unauthorized act that is won by a social or normal or moral or military norms, or even an SOP, under United States versus Johnson, does not equal to a criminal act. And that goes to that unlawfulness issue. What we say with regard to the evidence, to sum up on the Brady issue, what Dr. McDonald's, what we believe original and only opinion about the Ottoman officer being shot first in the chest while he was standing with his arm outstretched. The reason that that's error and the reason this court should reverse is following the lead of Kyle versus Whitley. And I just want to close with giving you four instances of how that could have been used to show why it's material. I know that we can establish error, but you also have to look at prejudice. One, the defense counsel was unable to argue that the government's expert agreed with the defense expert because we didn't know about it. The fact that the government's expert agreed with impeached the witnesses and theory of the government and corroborated the witnesses and theory of the defense is material under Kyle versus Whitley. And the members weren't able to consider that evidence in their findings, in their deliberations. And the defense counsel was also unable to object to government counsel's cross-examination of Lieutenant Behenna and her final argument, when she sort of made fun of Lieutenant Behenna's testimony, which was exactly the same, describing the scenario as Dr. McDonald's. And when she said that the forensics were clear and that it was an impossible situation. And lastly, with regard to the sentence, we believe it's a very reasonable inference to make that the members would have returned a far less severe, a much more lenient sentence for an accused person who was convicted of shooting someone who was reaching for his weapon, even though he lost his right to self-defense under this limiting instruction, than they would have for somebody who was executed while they're sitting on a rock, which is what the government's theory was. The testimony is at JA 256 on, and then the affidavit is at
I have the affidavit.
JA 301.
Roger that. Thank you, counsel. Did you have an opportunity to finish?
Well, I think I'd leave the court with this.
This is a summation of the summation?
Well, if Judge, I'm going to sit down because if you ask me again, I'd keep on talking.
Okay. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 5 past the hour. Thank you.